Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books and Gender Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Sasha Rosneal, Professor of Interdisciplinary Social Science at the Institute of Advanced Studies and Dean of the Faculty of Social and Historical Studies at University College London, to talk about the new book, The Tenacity of the Couple Norm, Intimate Citizenship Regimes in a Changing Europe, out 2020 with UCL Press. Hello, Sasha.
Hi, nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Yeah, we can actually see each other. We're not recording.
Even though it's a podcast, I can see you, but everyone else can't see us. Yep.
It's nice, you know. I think it'll be better for the conversation as well. How are you today? How's London?
Well, the sun's shining. It looks like spring is coming, and my vaccine is booked, so that does feel like spring is coming. It feels like we might be on our way out of this lockdown,
not just
crisis.
Yeah, like, and then existentially, like a metaphorical spring, as well as this really dreary winter. I think it's hard to appreciate just how horrific the weather is up in the North Atlantic unless you've really experienced weeks without the sun. It can really get to you.
It's the greyness, isn't it? It's the kind of relentless grey. It's not that it's been particularly cold this winter. It really hasn't. I mean, global warming means we don't get really cold winters anymore. But they're grey and wet and dark and, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, they are. Not today, though. Not today.
That spring is coming.
Woo! All right. Okay, so I want to put this book in the context of your career. So you have a couple of monographs really early on, Disarming Patriarchy, Feminism and Political Action, and then Common, that was 1995, and Common Women, Uncommon Practices, The Queer Feminisms of Green Common, in 2000, that kind of explore how feminism, as it interacts with political movements. And then, you know, and then you move into, there's this whole series of edited volumes, Remaking Citizenship in Multicultural Europe, Women's Movements, Gender and Diversity. That's 2012 with Palgrave. Beyond Citizenship, Feminism and the Transformation of Belonging, 2013 with Palgrave. Reproducing Citizens, Family, State, and Civil Society, 2015 with Routledge. So these collections all kind of seem to cluster around and grapple with the norms of identity within the broader corporate private bodies in a rapidly changing modern Europe. So is that's a fair way to characterize your interests up until now? I mean, I know that's a very incomplete look at your CV, but still.
It's interesting, isn't it, how you may appear to someone from what they see in your CV. I suppose if I was describing what I've worked on, I would say, my first kind of big body of work, piece of work was from my PhD, and that was about Green and Common and women's political activism. It was about the sort of anti-nuclear movement, but really it was about how women pursue projects of the collective projects of social change that also impact upon them as individuals in kind of unexpected ways. So I've always, I suppose, had an interest in women's collective action in social movements. And in the kind of personal motivations and transformations that being involved in activism bring about. So that was kind of an early body of work. I then did a long project, which I published some of on the way, but it's really my next big book project, which was a kind of 20-year long ethnographic project. Too long, and it really needs to be published as a book. But there were quite a lot of papers along the way, and that was really about intimate life and how intimate life has changed. It was based in three places in Yorkshire, and I was interested in the experiences of people living outside kind of conventional couples and families, and their relations and practices of care and intimacy. And so I published quite a lot of stuff on that, but actually over time that project took different forms, and that's the next book. So maybe I'll talk to you about that when that's finished. But then I got involved in a big European project, EU funded project, out of which came the book we're talking about today, The Tenacity of the Couple Norm. And that also took some time. So that was a project. The bigger project that this was part of was called FemSit, which stood for Gender Citizenship in Multicultural Europe, the Impact of Contemporary Women's Movements. That was the title of the project. At its biggest, I think we had about 40 researchers, 40 feminist researchers working on the project across 9 countries. And the overarching question we were trying to answer was, what difference have women's movements made to gendered citizenship over the last 40 years? Where are we now in multicultural Europe? So citizenship was a theme, the common theme, I suppose, and women's movements. So it brought together a collection of feminist scholars from across Europe interested in those two things, citizenship and women's movements. And that project, it was an amazing project. So Phil, it's been so formative for me, that experience of working in that big European project. I was one of the scientific directors, and there were 6 streams of it, each looking at a different dimension of citizenship. And the stream that I was running, the work package I was running, was the one on intimate citizenship. So you see the title of the book has the concept of intimate citizenship in it. But when we started the work, we didn't have any idea we'd write a book about the couple norm. It really was something that emerged out of the research. So the specific research question for that work stream was to explore the impact of women's movements and lesbian and gay movements. So I don't think you can look at intimate life, intimate citizenship, if you're not also looking at the impact of LGBT movements. So what impact have those movements had on intimate citizenship over the last 40 years? That was the question. And I drew together a team to study 4 countries. So each of the different work packages of the FemSit project looked at different countries, which if we were starting again, I think we might not have done that, because it meant it was harder to look at the data across the different streams of citizenship. So political citizenship, economic citizenship, so on. But it gave us an incredible diversity of different countries. So in my project, Intimate Citizenship Project, we were looking at the UK, Portugal, Bulgaria and Norway. So kind of 4 corners of Europe and 4 different welfare regimes, 4 different kind of histories of relationships to democracy different in many dimensions. But we had in Norway, we had a Nordic welfare state tending to gender equality, woman-friendly Nordic welfare state in Helga Hernes's terms. We had Bulgaria as a former communist country, post-socialist state. Portugal as a southern European welfare state, ex-dictatorship, kind of strongly Catholic. And then the UK as a kind of northwestern European liberal or neoliberal, if you want, welfare state. So 4 corners of Europe, 4 different welfare state regimes. And the questions that we were looking at, the sort of sub-questions were, we wanted to, first of all, map the history of the claims of the social movements in the 4 countries. So what was the women's movement asking for, demanding, claiming in relation to intimate life, intimate citizenship? since about 1968, and similarly across the other countries, what was the lesbian and gay movement demanding, claiming from the state, from civil society? So sort of a piece of historical work, and then a piece of kind of legal and policy analysis of each country. So mapping the law and policy frameworks in each country over that period of time in order to try and explore the relationship between the claims and demands of the social movements and the ways that law and policy did or didn't change. And then finally, the biggest piece of work that took most of our time and which substantially the book draws on, we did interviews with people in each of the countries. And I can tell you a bit about those interviews if you're interested.
I would love to. Before we get into kind of what we end up having here, I want to talk about how you worked with other authors. All right. So, and you have four other
There's five. Yeah, four others. There's five of us all together.
Five of you all together.
Yeah.
How did you decide to work together, and how did that go?
So Turner Hellicent was absolutely key in the project. In fact, she initiated the overarching FemSit project. It was kind of her idea. She said she saw the call that came out from the European Union, the European Commission, on wanting work on gender and citizenship. And she got in touch with me and a handful of other people and said, let's do something. She was kind of from a historian by training, by inclination. She contacted me as a sociologist, a bunch of other people, small number of us. And we got together and started talking about what we wanted to do. We knew we wanted to do something on women's movements, but the framework that we were being offered was citizenship. So it had to be something that was about citizenship and women's movements. And we were all quite excited about this idea, which we then worked up and put in the grant application, and amazingly enough, we got it. It was you know, quite surprising to us that the European Union was going to give us €4 million to do this feminist project that we really wanted to do about women's movements in Europe. But the conceptualization that I kind of helped develop of different strands of work on different dimensions of citizenship. You know, I was very clear I wanted to do a project on intimate citizenship. I've been doing all this work on intimacy and intimate life. And Turner basically said, well, I want to be on the intimate citizenship strand too. So that gave the two of us. And then the other three, Anna Christina Santos, was a PhD student of mine at the University of Leeds, and Maria Stoileva was also a PhD student of mine, also at Leeds. They were respectively Portuguese and Bulgarian, and quite honestly, that's how I decided we would do Portugal and Bulgaria. These were the people I wanted to work with on the project. They seemed like, you know, sensible countries to choose. We were going to have to do Portugal or Italy or Spain. There was Christina, let's do Portugal. Going to do Poland or the Czech Republic or Bulgaria, or let's do Bulgaria because there's Maria. And then Isabel actually responded to an advert. It was a job advert to do the UK stream of the research. And so Isabel came on board and we formed our team. It's been an amazing feminist collaboration from my perspective anyway. We're still all really good friends, which is a great achievement, I think, when you've worked together for a long time. I think we started working, well, Turner and I started working together on the project in 2005, maybe. We were first talking about the ideas.
Wow.
It was a long time coming, and then we did the interviews. I guess we started the interviews in kind of 2009. The funding ran out, of course, long before we'd written the book. Which is why holding the group together, continuing to work together when we didn't have any funding anymore, we'd all gone off to do different things. Everyone was working on other things, other projects, new jobs. We all remained very committed to writing this book, and finally we got it done.
Wonderful. That's impressive, actually. That's a long time to spend kind of sorting these kind of asking questions and I want to note this for our listeners. This is something that comes up a lot when I talk to authors, is how much your study, much like your life, just kind of happens. You know, you have this idea about what you want to do, but then you meet the collaborators that you really want to work with. Or, you know, I interview a lot of historians and they're like, well, and then I found this document and that changed everything. You have like the best laid plans for research, and then it kind of takes on a life of its own, which I think is delightful.
Absolutely. And that's the reality of doing research. I mean, one of the things I always look for when I'm interviewing prospective PhD students is, you know, I'm asking questions to really explore whether they're prepared to be surprised by what they find and whether they're prepared to move with the material, you know, whether it's archival material, whether it's interview material, whether it's people that they meet and talk to. You know, are they going to stay rigidly attached to the first idea they encountered, you know, the idea they started the project with, or will they be changed and moved and transformed by what they encounter? And, you know, we as a group were absolutely that, you know, that this book was not where we thought, it's not what we thought we'd write.
Well, and one should hope not, right? One should hope that the story you make up for the grant proposal in the beginning isn't actually what happens, or then why have I bothered to do this work? Yeah. Oh, I think that's great. That sounds really fun. This sounds like it would have been.
It was the most incredible fun. I mean, I can't show you because we're doing a podcast, some of the photos of our team meetings, but, you know, the whole FEMSIC group had a lot of fun. You know, one of the great things about it being a kind of European collaboration was that we had, it seems like another world, but we had meetings in different countries. So we traveled a lot. You know, we had regular meetings about every 6 months of the whole team, and we'd go to different places, and each meeting would be hosted by one of our colleagues from that place. So we got to go to really nice places to eat in Istanbul and Toulouse and Leiden, and I hosted the UK meeting, and we actually had it at this amazing place in the grounds of Windsor Castle, Cumberland Lodge. But, you know, so each person responsible sort of took us to somewhere special in their home city or home country. But the intimate citizenship team, we were largely based in London at Birkbeck. It was just Turner, who was based in Bergen in Norway, and the rest of the team was based in London, and we mostly had our meetings in London, but we had a huge amount of fun. We worked incredibly hard, not least because of the methodology that we chose, which was very, very intensive in terms of group work. So we did a lot of work as a team, you know, I think we were just very fortunate that we got on with each other, and we had a lot of fun as well as working hard.
Wonderful. All right, so let's talk about this very important notion that shows up quite regularly, is a fundamental kind of framing for the book, the idea of the intimate citizenship regime. Can you explain, well, tell us who came up with this idea, and what does this mean, and how does it work?
I think we coined the term in the book. I mean, certainly I got quite interested in regime thinking probably before this project, actually. But I'd been doing quite a lot of reading in social policy, comparative social policy, as part of a previous project, encountered the kind of notion of welfare regime. And in the kind of comparative social policy literature, there's kind of been a bit of a proliferation of different types of regimes people have been writing about. But, you know, one of the responses to the literature on welfare regimes was a discussion about gender regimes, and kind of about how gender had been ignored in Esping Anderson's work on welfare regimes. So welfare regimes, gender regimes, and starting to think comparatively about intimate citizenship threw up for me the idea that actually we were talking here about regimes, about kind of national differences in the ways that law and policy and everyday culture kind of conglomerate and you know, create a sort of formation that has some solidity over time, that has some kind of path dependency, that kind of you know, pushes the direction of travel in a particular way. So it's absolutely not to say that the intimate citizenship regimes don't change within a country. They absolutely do. But, you know, there is a kind of direction of travel that is possible given what's gone before. And I think that's one of the things that the idea of a regime conjures up. It's a kind of way in which things are ordered and regulated, not in an absolutely determining way. I mean, you know, this is not a fascist regime. It's a kind of way of describing how the law and policy and cultures that govern intimate life or intimate citizenship, how they're arrayed together.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's you know, there's a dialectic there, right? From the amount that how individual actors can behave within the system.
It's about the system within which people operate in terms of their intimate lives, the framework within which they live, and it's about trying to draw together, I suppose, the relationship between law and policy and culture and social relations, and how they kind of hang together.
Right, and feed on one another.
Yeah.
It's also, I mean, it's essential when you're talking about places as diverse as Bulgaria and Norway to sort out that you have very different systems, right? We have the same kind of species is interacting there, but within these very different ecosystems.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. All right. So there are four core norms of intimate citizenship at work here: the gender norm, the hetero norm, the procreative norm, and the couple norm. And we'll get into the couple norm in much greater detail in a couple minutes. But I want to get in that there are these very different regimes at play, very different normative behaviors, and that it's incredibly important, and I want our listeners to hear this, that there's this understanding that these have been understood, these norms, as why they're norms, is that they're universal kind of from time immemorial, and that they're natural rather than constructed. And I think that's, there is such a rhetorical power to the idea of what's natural and the assumptions within which we work, that I just want to make sure that is out there for our listeners, that there's these things. And you refer to them as constitutive. And I'm wondering if you could explain to us what you mean by that.
What I mean is that they constitute us as people, and they constitute intimate citizenship regimes. They have a kind of productive, creative power, and they enable, but they also constrain. They give shape to our intimate lives. The gender norm, the norm that differentiates between men and women, sees men and women as complementary and different, and arrays them in hierarchy. The heteronorm that kind of, you know, that determines heterosexuality as the natural normal way of having an intimate life. The procreative norm that determines that reproduction, having children, is, you know, what intimate life is all about. And the couple norm, which is what we primarily address in the book, that the idea that to be a good citizen, to be a normal citizen, to be a full citizen, to be an adult, successful adult, you should be part of a couple. These four norms are kind of, again, we didn't start with this analysis, although you can see how these are not completely brand new ideas. You know, they're available to us in the kind of feminist literatures, but, you know, we identified these four norms in our analysis of the law and policy of the four countries, and very powerfully in the stories that our interviewees told us. So as we were doing our analysis, these kind of norms just started shouting at us, really. And, you know, in the end, we decided to focus on the couple norm for the book. We've certainly got a book to write about each of these norms, but we decided to focus on the couple norm because we thought that was what had least been discussed. And maybe not, maybe actually the procreative norm has also not been much discussed, but there's a significant literature about gender norms, gender normativity, and heteronormativity, to which, you know, we've also contributed a bit. But and it's not to say no one's talked about about the normativity of the couple either. There is a literature on that, but not a kind of systematic exposition and examination.
Well, no,
we try to do.
It's not a key search term, is it? Couple normativity, the way heteronormativity, or right? That's there's something about feeling that they're inevitable, feeling that these are suggested, and of course you're going to come across them as is such a good demonstration of how powerful they are. Another key term, a kind of key idea to understand is the category of citizen and what it means to be a citizen, which is far beyond basic legal definitions of where you were born or what have you. Can you talk about the implications for citizenship? Like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think that it's good to alight on this, because the way we're talking about citizenship in the book and the way the whole FemSit project approached citizenship was not perhaps the way that kind of mainstream political science or political theory might approach it. So we were very much working with and seeking to develop a feminist understanding of citizenship, rooted in a kind of, basic originary women's liberation movement idea that the personal is political. So citizenship is more than just political representation. It's not just whether you can vote or not. And it's not just about women's representation in conventional politics, although we had a stream of work in FemSit on that. The political citizenship stream was about that. But in FemSit, in defining six different dimensions of citizenship that we were going to look at, we were expanding the conceptualization of citizenship right across the kind of experience of life. So citizenship to us means political citizenship, it means social citizenship, it means economic citizenship. We looked at religious citizenship, religious and ethnic citizenship. We looked at sexual citizenship and intimate citizenship. Have I got them all there? Is that six? I think so.
Wow. All right. Okay. Good. Yeah. You listed six. Well done.
Yeah. Okay. my memory is not completely shot. We were kind of approaching the idea of the citizen in a much more all-encompassing way. Citizenship is about the whole of kind of human experience, and it's about how we relate to the state and how the state relates to us, and it's about how we relate to civil society and how civil society relates to us across the different dimensions of life and social experience. So the FemSit project, and I think you mentioned, I don't know if you mentioned the book that came out of FemSit. So we produced a kind of overarching kind of collective book from the FemSit project, sets out our kind of, way of thinking about citizenship as a much more expansive feminist concept, which we then take forward in this book. We take forward the kind of thinking about intimate citizenship. But, again, not to claim originality to the idea of intimate citizenship was, I think, quite who first coined it, I'm not sure, but we draw a lot on the work of Ken Plummer, the British sociologist, and Geoffrey Weeks is also, I think Geoffrey Weeks and Ken Plummer, two British kind of sociologists of sexuality, gay sociologists, who used the term kind of long before we did. So we sort of stand on their shoulders with the concept, but they kind of offered it as a proposition. And, what we wanted to run with was kind of, a real empirical investigation of the concept and its usefulness.
Well, I think there's something when you think about citizenship as well, it involves like a fullness of being involved, mattering. We tend to talk about being a productive or member of society, which means your ability to produce and consume, and so there's this something about being a whole person that, but this reflects in your intimate citizenship the way you must behave on the private stage in order to be publicly acceptable is fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, I think if we're talking about citizenship, we're talking about the extent to which people are included, within the social, within the realm of the social, within the realm of the political, extent to which they're recognized. Recognized for their whole selves, the extent to which that certain parts of oneself have to stay unacknowledged. I think that's when we're getting to the realm of intimate citizenship, those questions of recognition are really, really crucial. You know, whether people's intimate lives are fully recognized or not by the state, by civil society, is key to whether someone is really able to be a full intimate citizen. That's how I understand it. I wrote a piece in European Journal of Women's Studies, I think it was published in 2010, where I kind of developed a kind of argument about what full intimate citizenship might be that we again take up in this book.
Mm-hmm. Right. So how do you get at that question? How do you approach, how do you possibly know what that means to people?
What it is to be a full intimate citizen.
Yeah. What? Yes.
So, so that, I mean, that's effectively what we wanted to do in the interview part of the study, to explore the extent to which people experienced full intimate citizenship, to the extent to which, I suppose their intimate lives, their experiences of intimate citizenship, had been impacted by the social movements that we were also studying. So that was the kind of starting point, you know, have people's intimate lives been impacted by those social movements? And that doesn't, this that kind of stream of analysis doesn't appear in the book, but, you know, we'd already published that elsewhere. So we set out to interview people in detail, in depth. We used the biographical narrative interpretive method, which is a method that kind of draws on traditions in kind of biographical analysis and narrative analysis, and kind of brings them together. It produces very rich interview material. So it involves, basically the method involves just asking one initial question, one single narrative inducing question, SQIN in the BNIM terminology. There's a lot of term, a lot of acronyms in the BNIM method, the biographical narrative interpretive method. But you basically formulate an initial question that you ask all your interviewees, the same initial question, and that's the kind of crux of the interview. Our question was, can you tell me the story of your personal life, all the events and experiences that have been important to you? Start wherever you like.
Go,
exactly. Now, some members of the team were a bit skeptical about this before we started it, a bit anxious about whether it was a method that would, that maybe would work for kind of people who are used to talking, you know, maybe people have been in therapy, or whether it was something that would particularly favour, you know, the kind of articulate middle classes. I had to persuade everyone to kind of give it a go and to run with it. But actually, we were all blown away with the amazing stories that we got as a result of this. The stories were of different lengths. You know, different people do answer that question in different ways. You know, the initial answer to that question varied enormously in length. But everyone we interviewed really appreciated the opportunity to tell their story. You know, people like to tell their story. They like to be listened to, and giving someone a space to tell the story of their personal life without interruption and, you know, with encouragement to continue when they kind of stall, is something that you know, allowed people to open up and talk about things that often they'd never talked about before. The second part of the interview, so after they'd kind of got to the end of telling their story and had been encouraged, is there anything else you want to say? Do you want to add anything? Then the second part was asking follow-up questions about things that they talked about in the first part of the interview. So the kind of basic rule of the method is that you don't ask about anything that hasn't been brought up by the interviewee. And this is kind of really important in the sense of being able to really just work with people's, it's not unprompted because you've asked them a question, but you're not pushing into the interview all your concepts, concerns, categories, you know, pre-framing. You know, you're then asking them basically, the follow-up is, can you tell me a bit more about the experience you had of X? Or, you know, you mentioned, you know, you had a really difficult time when you were at college, you know, in relation to your relationships. Tell me a bit more about that. Or you mentioned having an abortion. You know, what was that like? And the idea is to try and get people to both expand on the narrative detail and get closer and closer to the kind of emotional reality of the experience. So we and you do that about what we did was we would ask follow-up questions about the kind of key things that people had mentioned in the interview that related to the issues of intimate citizenship that we were interested in. So we had, you know, we developed a kind of set of and identified a kind of whole set of issues to do with intimate citizenship that we had explored that came first of all out of the claims and demands of the social movements that we were studying. We then followed up in looking at the kind of legal and policy frameworks around those issues and trying to relate the claims and demands of the movements to the law and policy. And then we wanted to see if those issues came up in people's stories. So what we would ask more about was about those things that were the intimate citizenship issues that originated in the women's movement. So that was the kind of method that we were drawing through the study. So we didn't follow up on absolutely everything that they said. But, you know, the interviews ended up being long and detailed, incredibly rich, and, you know, full of material about the complexity of intimate citizenship and how people's intimate lives are structured in relation to law and policy and social relations and culture. But without us asking explicitly about those things, you know, we never asked them about the law. Did you ever have an encounter with the law? But, you know, quite often we heard about that. We certainly never asked them, you know, what do you think about the women's movement or what did you think about the lesbian and gay movement? You know, but actually we ended up having a lot to say about how feminism, the women's movement had impacted on their lives. So that was the method. You know, we gathered these long, detailed biographical narratives from our interviewees. And then we did a lot of work analysing them. And there's a whole methodology, a whole kind of approach to the analysis of data in the method that we operationalised. We did a 5-day training course in this method at the beginning too. So the originators of the method kind of offer a kind of training course, and we did that as a group. And that was also really incredibly useful in terms of kind of ensuring that when everyone went off to their different places, you know, for many months to do the interviews, that we were all kind of working in the same way, had the same understanding of the method, you know, we're doing it in the same way. I said that when we came back with the interviews to work together on the analysis, we had a kind of set of interviews that had been conducted in comparable ways across the four countries.
Right. You say they were long, like hours, many days?
No, not day. I mean, sometimes they did take place over more than one day. I can't actually remember what the kind of, we did some analysis of what the average length of time was and different, you know, were they different in different countries and things. I mean, I think they varied. Probably the very shortest was about an hour. The very longest was probably 6 hours, something like that. I'd have to check. I guess they ended up, you know, on average about between 2 and 3 hours, maybe. Different groups did speak in different ways, for sure. You know, people tell their stories in different ways. And we were interviewing, all our interviewees were members of different types of minoritized groups. So in each country, we had chosen two minoritized, racialized groups to interview. So in each country, we interviewed members of the kind of majority population, but also of two minoritized and racialized groups. And everyone we interviewed was either single or in a same-sex relationship, lesbian, gay, or in a same-sex relationship, or in a non-cohabiting relationship, a living apart together relationship, or living in a shared housing. So everyone we interviewed was living in some ways outside kind of conventional families and couples. That's what they had in common. So in that sense, they were all kind of sort of marginal to the kind of to the mainstream, to the intimate mainstream. And then they were also two members of two different minoritized groups in each country, and then also members of the majority population. So we interviewed in the UK, we interviewed members of the Pakistani and Turkish communities. In Norway, members of the Pakistani and Sami community, the indigenous minority. In Bulgaria, Roma and Turkish minorities. And in Portugal, Roma, and Cape Verdean minorities.
Okay.
So there were differences in how people told their stories, and you know how lengthy they were, but not straightforwardly mapped actually onto any obvious difference. It wasn't straightforwardly the case that the kind of middle class educated white people, you know, talked in one way and other people talked in other ways. There were real sort of cross-cutting differences across the different groups. And we haven't done a kind of analysis that settles on trying to compare the different groups. That wasn't what we wanted to do. We considered it. But actually, the way we ended up presenting the materials in the book was in terms of individual case studies, because the danger of making any individual representative of their group, you know, that's a problem with this kind of biographical narrative work. You become very attuned both to the specificity of everyone's kind of individual personal experience, but also to its social nature and you know how it is contextual and related to their social position, but we didn't want to set any you know, also it's a small sample, you know, we interviewed 67 people, it's not a survey, but it's big enough to be able to say some interesting things.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I mean that's obviously a choice that you made for good reason. You didn't just only find 67 people who would talk to you, obviously, right?
How many of these long interviews. I mean, the interview in itself is actually the sort of shortest thing that you do, because it's the analysis that is very, very time consuming with this method. So we didn't have time. We didn't have the funding to do any more than 67 interviews.
That is a respectable sample size. I understand, yeah. There are studies that focus on thousands of people or whatever, the big data, la la. But that is a respectable study size. Well done. And actually, it's a little bit bogglingly massive, actually. And I can't imagine doing something like quite that big that feels like this. But I suppose having five of you helped. And just someone to talk to and massive amounts of time. We're closing in on the end. So I really want to get to it, kind of the heart of this. You know, as noted before, it's assumed that this norm, the couple norm, is universal, timeless, and natural. But it's inherent here in the study to note that it isn't. It's not a foregone conclusion. This was a series of choices that were made. This is the way we've developed. So it's not the only nor the unquestionably best way to organize an intimate life. Why does it stick around? Why is it so, as you call it, tenacious?
Yeah, that's the $6 million question. Yeah. Because certainly what we found amongst our interviewees was both that the couple norm was very powerful in their lives and stories. And these are people who are living aslant to the couple norm. You know, they are experiencing its pressure on them. They're experiencing how it kind of compels them in certain directions, how it impacts their kind of sense of what's possible or what they should do. But also a lot of them were resisting it, you know, so there was a lot of evidence of people kind of challenging it, both, you know, actively, consciously, you know, statedly saying, you know, I don't want to conform. They didn't you quite use the concept of the couple norm, but, you know, all sorts of kind of interesting experiments in different ways of living that were kind of at odds with the couple norm. You know, the heterosexual woman who was sharing her life with her gay male friend. They lived together. They were, you know, deeply, powerfully bonded. In some ways, they were a couple, but they weren't a conventional couple. But they also both had relationships with other people. But and also kind of women, particularly women who were profoundly committed to friends, either to one particular friend, female friend. One woman we interviewed in London who talked about how she wanted to have a civil partnership with her best friend. Again, another kind of version of a couple, but also, you know, groups of friends and really kind of centering around groups of friends. So, you know, quite conscious resistance, but also less clearly articulated resistance, you know, where perhaps there wasn't the same access to a kind of a sense of agency but a kind of profound resistance to the expectations of, you know, settling down and getting married. So both kind of the people we talk to experiencing the power of the couple norm, but also, you know, engaging in kind of everyday resistance. Why does it persist in spite of that? I mean, there's a kind of a bit of a psychoanalytic excursion at the end of the book, which, you know, is probably more me than the other authors, where we look at how, you know, what is it about the dyad that might be so compulsive? You know, so is it just the kind of social norm that's operating here, or is there something else going on? And I'm quite interested in the idea of the normative unconscious, which is developed by American psychoanalytic theorist Lynn Layton, who talks about how normativity gets inside our kind of unconscious. The unconscious isn't something that's asocial. It is socially produced, and so operates kind of from within as well as from without. So there's a good discussion towards the end of the book about the kind of psychosocial dimensions of the couple norm, not just seeing it as kind of imposed from the outside, but also something that you know is experienced very powerfully as a kind of internal pressure. And then also moving on to thinking about, well, whether there might also be something about the kind of fundamental relationality of what it is to be a human being. And perhaps something that goes back to our very gestation. You know, we are gestated inside the body of our mothers, inside the body of another human being. We're kind of fundamentally relational and connected to one other person from the very beginning. And maybe there is something about that. This is kind of psychoanalytic speculation on my part, but maybe there is something rather fundamental about that, and that that means that there is comfort in a close, deep attachment to one other person that perhaps exceeds the kind of social pressure. And it's impossible to detach it from the social pressure, the social and cultural pressure of the couple norm, because that's always there. But there is something kind of interesting to explore about the relationship between the kind of psychic and relational aspects of the couple norm and the more clearly social and cultural aspects. And that's this kind of psychosocial terrain that I have kind of longer standing and more broad ranging interest in, I suppose. I'm also a psychotherapist, a psychoanalytic therapist, group analyst. So there's a certain kind of excursion into some of those ideas at the end of the book.
So is that what's next? Are you going to continue with this?
Well, the group of us who wrote the book are working together at the moment on another paper. We found it impossible not to turn our attention to the coronavirus crisis, and we're working on something about the couple and coronavirus and intimate citizenship regimes, because, you know, it's a really interesting case study. If we can detach ourselves enough from the experience of living through it, you know, what does the current crisis and the way that states have intervened in kind of exceptional, extraordinary ways in all of our kind of everyday freedoms, what does that say about intimate citizenship regimes? You know, what assumptions have states made about the forms of intimate life that we have, about how they might regulate them? So we've been looking again at our four countries, because we kind of know quite a lot about the countries now and their histories, to see whether there are differences in how the four countries have responded to the crisis in terms of how they have tried to regulate intimate life. You know, what rules and what assumptions have they made about how people live their intimate lives? Because the regulations around COVID-19 are shot through with assumptions about how people live. And in fact, you know, coronavirus is a virus of intimate contact. So, you know, it's kind of perfect case study. So we've kind of come back together to do a piece of work on that. That's our current work. But I've also got other stuff to do. I've got, as I said earlier, I've got this 20-year-long ethnographic project called Living Change, which I need to get on with writing up as well.
Wow. I'm really taken by the idea of this coronavirus project. Yeah. And the way that states have intervened to protect the relationships they deem essential and separate others is very, that's compelling. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that all is. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today. This was lovely, a nice, lovely break.
Pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Wonderful.
Thank you for inviting me.
Wonderful. And we'll talk some more about over the next project. Maybe we'll get together
I
for
look
this.
I'll talk to it. Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you.
Bye-bye.